You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Daniels. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. This is part 6 of that series for 2009. Rick Britton introduces today's guest speaker.
A couple of things I wanted to tell you real quick first. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this before, but we're being recorded for the Seville Podcasting Network. And so if you go to their website, CivillePodcastingNetwork.com, you can look up my name or you can look up the Civil War, and you'll go to this whole series and the series for last year, and you can push a button and listen to it via the internet, listen to the lectures you might have missed. The reason I'm telling you that is because I had no idea, and there's the gentleman right back, there's Dan. I had no idea, but some of the talks have become very popular. In fact, some of them have been downloaded literally hundreds and hundreds of times. So folks are doing them, so now y'all have the opportunity. I don't think I'd ever mentioned that. Had I ever mentioned that before? I don't think I had. Okay. The speaker tonight is a good friend of mine. He was for 25 years the historian at Appomattox Courthouse, so he knows a little bit about the Appomattox campaign. He's a friend of mine. He's a good friend to our series, too. If you remember, he spoke to us last year about the entire campaign, and he did that in 45 minutes, which was quite an amazing test of his ability. So please join me in welcoming Ron Wilson.
Rich has mentioned, and I think it might be best to put him in some sequential order. And if you're going on the tour, I would suggest that you take these along with you. The tour map. Then the next map should be the Battle of Lewis Farm. Okay. Followed by the Battle of White Oak Road, or Hatcher's Run, followed by the Battle of Dinwiddie Courthouse, and then finally the Battle of Five Forks. So I have about 40 minutes to do four battles. And they all build actually upon one another. They're sequential in a certain context, I think it's somewhat significant that you know about that context. Let's start out first and simply say the Army of Northern Virginia under Robert E. Lee had defended Richmond and Petersburg for the last 9.5 months, from mid-June of 1864 to now April of 1865. Lee's line was nearly 30 miles long, from northeast of Richmond to southwest of Petersburg. The federal armies operating against him under General Ulysses S. Grant had severed by early April of 1865 all of the railroads supplying Lee's army into Petersburg, except for the South Side Railroad, which ran east from Lynchburg. So when the roads began to dry in the early spring, making maneuver possible, we could anticipate what Grant is going to try to do. Quite simply, known to everyone, he's going to try to sever that last railroad going into Petersburg, forcing Lee to come out of those entrenchments and meet Grant in open field. On the 24th of March, Grant sent the following instructions to his army commanders, they being General George G. Meade, who commanded the Army of the Potomac, General Edward O.C. Cresap Ord, who commanded the Army of the James, And General Philip Sheridan, what army did he command? You can't answer, Rick. Okay. Sheridan commanded the Army of the Shenandoah. Okay. So on the 24th, they all received the same message from Grant. And it said, on the 29th instant, the armies operating against Richmond will be moved to our left for the double purpose of turning the enemy out of their present position around Petersburg and to ensure the success of the cavalry under General Sheridan, which will start on the same time in its effort to reach and destroy the South Side Railroad and the Danville Railroad. Okay. So those are their instructions, which General Grant has issued on the 24th, and he's putting this into effect on the 29th. Okay. On the 25th of March, however, General Lee will assume the offensive. General Gordon's corps will attack federal position at Fort Stedman on the eastern flank of the Petersburg lines. It was an attempt to force Grant to shorten his lines, bring them in from the western outreaches, and force his men back to the east, giving Lee an opportunity then, if possible, if he needed an avenue of escape, to move to his west. It started out quite successfully. Gordon captured Fort Stedman, opened up a sizable hole in the federal lines, but the Federals were able to readjust their position, bring more men into the battlefield, and by noon it was all over. Gordon had lost 4,000 men, which the Army could not afford. Most of those were captured. The 26th of March, Phil Sheridan reported to General Grant, and he brought with him from the Shenandoah Valley two cavalry divisions under Tom Devon and under George Custer. By having these two cavalry divisions join General Grant in the Petersburg area, Grant was able now to develop a mobile strike force. On the 27th and 28th of March, President Abraham Lincoln, General Grant, General Sherman, and Admiral Porter met aboard the River Queen at City Point to discuss the closing operations, or what would become the closing operations of the war in the East, along with some other concerns that would be dealt with of what to do with the Confederates once they capitulated. The weather at this time also would play a factor, as it always does in any military operation. Okay. This endeavor involved a great deal of cross-country marching by a large number of troops, and the soldiers were not inspired. In the area beyond Hatcher's Run and approaching Burgess's Mill, the men felt that the infernal country smacked too much of the wilderness. It was flat, covered with timber and underbrush, seamed with swampy creeks and rivers, a bad place to march, a worse place to make a bivouac, and apparently a wholly impossible place for a battle. And just when things were at their worst, it began to rain, and it rained in great drenching sheets. The flat country had no proper drainage, so that the smallest creek quickly became a deep stream, and the meadows turned into heavy swamps, and the roads became mud beds in which artillery and wagon trains could not move. Let's look at our tour map, because we want to come familiar with certain geographic features that are highlighted here. Where it has a number one and a circle on it, called the Vaughan Road Quaker Road intersection. Okay, if you've located that, we're going to be talking about that as we progress. Now, this would be the tour map. This would be the tour map, the big map. There'd be a number one with a little circle around it, and then if you look directly to the north of that, you'll see a number two, which is site of the Battle of Lewis Farm. And then number three will be the Boynton Plank Road crossing of Gravelly Run. Number four would be the Battle of White Oak Road. Number five, now had to come back toward the center and lower part of the map, would be the Dinwiddie Courthouse area. Six would be an area just to the northwest of Dinwiddie called Chamberlain's Bed. Seven is Five Forks. And a thing called the Shad Bake. Number eight is the all-important Southside Railroad. That's number nine is Gillum's Field, Burnt Quarter, and the Rebel Escape Route. And number 10 is Gravelly Run Methodist Episcopal Church. And we'll mention almost all of those tonight, give you an idea where they're located and their relationship one to another. Okay. So let's turn our attention now to the 29th of March. General Grant's instructions indicated that would be the day. And Warren's, General Gouverneur Kimball Warren's 5th Army Corps, Army of the Potomac, was to move to the junction of the Quaker and Vaughan Roads and await then the arrival of Andrew A. Humphrey's Federal 2nd Corps, which would then fill in on his right flank. General Sheridan would begin then to strike toward Dinwiddie Courthouse and attempt to entice the Confederates to leave their breastworks and fight in the open. Portions of Edward Otho Cresap's Army of the James, which was in the Richmond Front, would have moved from Richmond Front, from the north of the James, and would hold sections of the federal line abandoned by the 6th Corps. So we're just relocating troops in anticipation of bolstering this mobile strike force, which is going to move to the west and then hopefully north to capture the railroad. Okay. Ord brought with him the 24th Army Corps under General Gibbon and two brigades of cavalry under Ranald McKenzie. He also brought a division of USCT, which were black soldiers, called United States Colored Troops. Horatio Wright's 6th Corps and John Park's 9th Corps would hold the siege lines around Petersburg itself directly. Okay. Grant's three armies, the Army of the Potomac, Army of the James, Army of the Shenandoah, would consist now of about 120,000 men of all arms. Okay. While Lee's army would consist of about half that number, about 60,000. But when we look at these men, they all haven't had the same rations. They all haven't lived under the same conditions. And that has to be taken into effect as well. The winter in Petersburg, winter 64, 65, was a very severe winter, and it had its toll on the Army, on both armies, but more so on the Confederate Army. Living in the open pretty much in trench conditions is quite a taxing situation. Okay. So Warren's 5th Corps would then move north on the Quaker Road, and now we might want to look at our Battle of Lewis Farm map. Okay? Now, at the bottom in the center of that map, it says Quaker Road. Okay? You can follow that as it goes north. It intersects a road then that goes off to the southwest, which is called the Boynton Plank Road. That's U.S. Highway 1 today. Okay? And then there's a road that crosses the top of the map called White Oak Road. Okay? And you'll see what is depicted on White Oak Road is the Confederate right defensive works along that road. And you'll see some of those that still exist today when you take the tour. Okay. Now, Lee realized that Grant was going after the South Side Railroad. That wasn't any mystery to anyone. And he would attempt, and Grant would attempt to turn his right flank, which was at the intersection of the White Oak Road and the Claiborne Road. And if you go back to your tour map and you look at number 4, where that circle is, that's the corner of the White Oak Road and Claiborne Road, and that was Lee's right flank. That was his right flank. Okay. So Grant's going to try to turn that using Sheridan and these other forces. Okay. The entrenchment from Burgess Mill on the Boynton Plank Road to Hatcher's Run on the Claiborne Road were held by Richard H. Anderson's corps, which consisted of one division. Normally, a corps has 3 divisions. This only has 1. And when we think of the Army of Northern Virginia, we think of 3 corps. Okay, but now we got a 4th. It's under Richard Anderson. And it consists only of Bushrod Anderson's division, about 4,800 men, and 4 artillery battalions under Hillary P. Jones. Okay. Lee decided to make effort to thwart Grant's operation by developing his own mobile strike force. Okay. But he's got less of a manpower pool to take it from. Okay. But his mobile strike force is going to consist of cavalry under Fitzhugh Lee, General Lee's nephew, which has 3 divisions, that of William Henry Fitzhugh Lee, which is General Lee's 2nd oldest son. Let's just say from now on we'll call him Rooney like everybody else did. Okay. Thomas Mumford. Now, Rooney had about 2,400 cavalrymen, and Tom Mumford had about 1,800. And the 3rd division was under Thomas Rosser. He had about 1,200. The infantry would consist of George E. Pickett's division. Pickett had things fairly easy defending an area called the Hallett Line between Appomattox and James Rivers. But he had now been moved to the Petersburg Front. And he had 4 brigades, and they all told together about 5,000 men. Okay. Montgomery D. Corse, William Terry, which was Kemper's old brigade, George H. Maryland Stewart, who had Armistead's old brigade, and Eppa Hutton, who had Garnett's old brigade. Okay, so we're not talking about any of those Gettysburg people, brigade commanders. They're all pretty much gone. Arriving near Sutherland Station on the 29th, with overall command under George E. Pickett, with a combined force, they were to seize the initiative and attack Sheridan's forces as they moved toward Dinwiddie Courthouse. Okay. However, Hutton's brigade and Samuel McGowan's brigade were sent to bolster Anderson's corps along the White Oak Road. Okay. So we have lots of movement starting to take place. Well, leading the 5th Corps northward up the Quaker Road was Joshua Chamberlain's brigade. Fording the waist-deep gravelly run, normally it's just something you can almost step across, but because of the heavy rains and conditions, you had to now negotiate it, and it was waist-deep. Chamberlain threw out skirmishers and advanced his 2 large regiments, the 198th Pennsylvania and the 185th New York. Okay. Upon reaching the Lewis Farm, a large Confederate force was seen beyond a sawmill at the edge of a clearing. Chamberlain halted until reinforced by Gregory's brigade, which went in on Chamberlain's left. The Southern troops Chamberlain saw were for Henry A. Wise's Virginia Brigade. As fighting began in earnest, Wise slowly fell back a mile toward the junction of the Boynton Plank Road and the Quaker Road. Seeing this retrograde movement, Anderson deployed William H. Wallace's South Carolinians and with Wise's brigade counterattacked and brought Chamberlain to a halt and forcing the Federal left flank to give way. Union artillery was then brought forward, Battery B of the 4th U.S. Light Artillery, for Napoleon's, and canistered and raked the southern lines. Bushrod Johnson then ordered Young M. Moody's Alabama Brigade with Matthew Ransom's North Carolinians, who was in support, and the three Confederate brigades attacked Chamberlain's line. Chamberlain sent a plea for help, at which point Charles Griffin, his division commander, sent him four regiments. Early in the fight, Chamberlain nearly escaped death. He'd been severely wounded in June, and there was a premature announcement of his death, but he did recover. But in this fight, a bullet meant for him struck his horse's neck, passed through. The bullet then struck the general's arm, which was raised, and followed it to his elbow. Bruised the elbow before hitting his left breast just above his heart. Glancing off a leather case of field orders and a brass-mounted hand mirror, which he had in his pocket, the bullet followed around two ribs and came out the back seam of his coat and unhorsed the staff officer. And although a painful wound, the main general stayed with his post throughout the campaign. Now, he was kind of bloody and combobulated here, but he did mount his horse again and did proceed into the battle. By seeing him in such condition, this bolstered his men's courage, and they followed him forward. And fresh troops, as fresh troops arrived to bolster Chamberlain's advance, Johnson's men began to give ground and fell back to the woods along the edge of a clearing. Anderson recalled Wise's, Wallace's, and Moody's men to the White Oak Road entrenchments. And at that point, the battle ceased. The Federals now, however, gained a foothold on one of Lee's supply routes. That was the Boynton Plank Road. When the Weldon Railroad had been captured, the Confederates had to unload supplies off the railroad down at Stony Point, put the supplies on wagons, and then bring them up the wagons up the Boynton Plank Road into Petersburg to supply the army. Now the Boynton Plank Road was no longer available, so now there's basically one supply route which is going to supply the Confederate armies in Petersburg, and that's the South Side Railroad. Okay. Confederate losses in this engagement were about 371, Union losses about 381. Rain fell heavily on the 30th. In fact, it hampered maneuvers so much that no large-scale fighting occurred on the 30th whatsoever. But Warren did advance closer to the White Oak Road. So we would turn our attention to the next map, the Battle of White Oak Road. Now, General Grant was under some inducement at this time to suspend operations because of the weather conditions. But very strong pressure was brought against him by General Sheridan and by his chief of staff, John Rollins, who persuaded the commanding general to continue with the planned operations. General Lee now rode out to Sutherland Station on the South Side Railroad to confer with his officers and decide that Pickett should take Corse's and Terry's and Stewart's brigades along with Ransom and Wallace's brigades, and marched to Five Forks. Okay. At that point, they would join Fitz Lee's cavalry, which had assembled there, and this is all three brigades, and then with the combined infantry under General Pickett and the combined cavalry under Fitz Lee, they would move south toward Dinwiddie Courthouse and take on Sheridan. On the morning of the 31st, Grant detached the 5th Corps from the Army of the Potomac and placed it directly under General Sheridan's command for operations. Sheridan had preferred, if he was to work with an infantry corps, and asked for the 6th Corps under General Wright, with whom he had worked very well in the Shenandoah Valley. But the 6th Corps is not available because of distances involved, and the 5th Corps was right on Sheridan's flank, and so they were assigned to General Sheridan. 5th Corps, not the 6th Corps, not being available. Okay. Well, confronting the entrenched Confederates along the White Oak Road was again Gouverneur Warren's 5th Army Corps. Ayres' division, Romeo Ayres, was on the left. Now, I might add that on these maps, the ones that have the hash marks on them, those show the final positions of the Federal forces. Okay, that's the secondary positions after they've basically fought. Ayres was on the left, extending west of the Claiborne Road, and on his right was Crawford's division, with Griffin's division in support. On the morning of the 31st, Robert E. Lee rode out. General Lee is quite busy, and he's personally managing all of most of these affairs. On the morning of the 31st, Robert E. Lee rode out to the White Oak Road lines, inspected them to confer with his generals, and met with Bushrod Johnston, and learned that the Federals were in front and that their left flank was exposed. They overlapped the Confederate position. Now, on that map, you might note where it says B.R. Johnson, there's a road that comes in from the north called the Claiborne Road. Okay? And it joins that road that runs across the map called the White Oak Road. Okay? Confederates are entrenched. You can see their entrenchments just to the west of the Claiborne Road and extending eastward on the White Oak Road. This is the Confederate right flank. However, a mobile force has been put together and is now 4 miles west of this point at Five Forks. Okay. Lee decided to initiate the offensive and ordered an attack. McGowan's division on the far right, then Stansel's brigade, McGowan's brigade was on the right, then Stansel's brigade, Moody was sick and was not in the battle, then Epahutton, and then further to the east was Henry Wise. Okay. They would have about 5,000 men, which would be the size of one Federal division. They are confronted by 3 Federal divisions. Okay. Ayres' division advanced, coming within 10 or 15 yards of the White Oak Road entrenchments when they saw the Confederates were preparing for an attack. Lieutenant John Holland of the 18th Virginia of Epahutton's brigade jumped up, sword in hand, and yelled, "Forward." Not too many battles are initiated by lieutenants, but this one is. That's why we have his name. And although not quite ready, McGowan's South Carolinians assailed Ayres' left flank, sending them in full retreat. The sudden southern attack caused a panic in Ayres' division, and his three brigades, about 5,000 men, scampered all the way back to Gravelly Run. Samuel Crawford, who was forming up for an impending attack, met the momentum of the southern attack caused on Ayres' division, and he fell back across Gravelly Run as Ayres had done before him. So two federal divisions were more or less routed. By 2:30 that afternoon, Ayres and Crawford had reformed, but Warren gave the order for a second attack, not to either one of them, but to General Griffin, Charles Griffin. Griffin's advance, supported by the divisions of Ayres and Crawford, forced the Confederates back into their entrenchments by 3:30 that afternoon. The Federals had effectively prevented Anderson's corps from reinforcing Pickett, who was at Five Forks. They held him in position, but that's a strange way to do it. Union casualties in this fiasco were 1,865. Confederate casualties were less than half, 800. We'll see later that Warren will undergo some criticism because of this battle, and we'll give back. We'll talk about that the next day on April 1st. Well, I want you to also note in the center part of the extreme left of your map where it says Bartlett. If you can see him, there's a little arrow, okay? Well, around 5 o'clock, General Warren received a message from Meade's headquarters that he was to secure his position, mainly just holding the Confederates in the White Oak Road entrenchments, and was to send a small force to the west to communicate with General Sheridan's forces. Warren sent Joseph Bartlett. Okay, so his brigade is starting off there to offer some assistance to Sheridan. Okay. Now, if that isn't quite as confusing as it should be, then we also have a battle occurring around Dinwiddie Courthouse on the same day, March 31st. Okay. So we have two battles, one at White Oak Road, the other at Dinwiddie Courthouse. Okay. The one at the White Oak Road is going to be an infantry battle. The one around Dinwiddie Courthouse is going to be cavalry and Southern infantry. Okay. Well, Pickett left on the 31st, he left his combined forces from Five Forks and moved south. He moved south. He moved along. We'll have to go back to our first map because it's got the roads on it. Okay, he's going to move. If you find Five Forks, which is surrounded by numbers 7, 9, and 11, okay, if you see Five Forks, Pickett's going to move down on this map toward a place called Center Star, which was called Little Five Forks at that time, okay? And part of his cavalry is going to move down Courthouse Road, if you can see that one coming out of Five Forks. Okay, Courthouse Road to the north and east, and here it's called Wheeler's Road. Historically, it was called Scott's Road. Okay, they're going to move down those two roads. Okay. And when they got to Ford Station, which is Little Five Forks, that intersection known as Little Five Forks, the column turned southeast toward Chamberlain's Bed, and you can see that on your Dinwiddie Courthouse map. There's a stream there on the left-hand side of your map that's labeled Chamberlain's Bed, okay, which normally is, again, a little small stream that spreads out when it's wet and creates swamps on both sides of it. Thomas Mumford's Southern cavalryman would move south along the Courthouse Road from Five Forks. The capture of some of the enemy soldiers, alerted Sheridan to Pickett's operation. Okay, found out they're in movement. They're coming down toward Dinwiddie Courthouse. Henry Davies' brigade. This is from Crook's Union cavalry. Henry Davies' brigade was sent to cover Dance's Ford over Chamberlain's Bed. Okay, Dance's Ford is the northern ford. If you can see that, it's got Pickett written, and then Dance's Ford on the other side of the stream. And then the southern ford is going to be protected by Charles Smith's brigade. Okay, those are the two crossings. Dance's Ford to the north, Fitzgerald's Ford to the south of Chamberlain's Bed. Okay. So we just got two federal cavalry brigades protecting one each protecting each one of those fords. The Confederates approached these fords about 2 o'clock that afternoon. Fitz Lee, with Rooney's and Tom Rosser's cavalry, were to force a passage of Fitzgerald's Ford, that's the southern ford, while the infantry would cross further north at Dance's Ford. Smith's federal cavalrymen would hold their position at Fitzgerald's Ford until about 5 o'clock that evening. Pickett's infantry forced their way over Dance's Ford, and Henry Davies ordered his men to fall back on the Courthouse Road toward it's also known as the Adams Road, and there's an Adams house there on your map. Meanwhile, Tom Mumford's cavalry, moving south from Five Forks on the Courthouse Road, encountered other federal cavalrymen, Thomas Devon's other two brigades under Peter Stagg and Charles Fitzhugh, and the Southerners were able to press the attack, forcing the Federals back to Courthouse Road, where the Crump Road branched off. Okay, we can kind of follow this battle by the numbers on your map that have circles on them. You see number one? Okay, it initiates, the battle is initiated there over the crossings of Chamberlain's Bed. Okay, two, we see that the Confederates have infantry has crossed and have pushed their infantry up, confronting other Union cavalry forces. Tom Mumford is going to bring his cavalry down the Courthouse Road, and they're going to force their way down toward Dinwiddie Courthouse. We see the infantry line and some Southern cavalry. Okay. Now, Pickett swung his infantry around in a battle line so that it faced south toward Dinwiddie. This battle is all going one way. Toward Pickett. Toward Fitz Lee. Sheridan's not doing too well. His brigades are fighting a very desperate situation, trying to hold what ground they can. When Southern infantry moved south, this would force Smith's brigade to leave their position along Chamberlain's Bed, and this allowed the Southern cavalry under Rooney, Lee, and Rosser to connect with Pickett's right flank. So the whole Confederate force now is bringing weight on Sheridan. However, I might mention some of these battles. They often begin very late in the day, and it's early spring. So we don't have daylight savings time, so sunset begins to take its place. Sheridan brought forward additional cavalry from Crook and Custer's division. Custer's men were guarding the wagon trains at this point. In fact, to get into this position at all in Dinwiddie, they had to corduroy the roads. That is, they cut trees where they could and laid them trunk to trunk to create a road surface which would enable them to move whatever wagons and implements that they needed. One thing we'll notice in these battles that I'm going to mention, there are very few artillery units that are going to participate simply because they couldn't be brought to bear because of the road conditions wouldn't allow their passage. Sheridan's able to eventually establish a battle line along a ridge just north of the village when night brought an end to the fighting. But he's been pushed all the way back to Dinwiddie Courthouse, and he is separated from the rest of the Federal Army. He does not have physical contact with them. Tactically, the Battle of Dinwiddie Courthouse is a victory for Pickett, General George Pickett. He had stopped Sheridan's advance cold. On the other hand, Sheridan looked at it in this way. He said, "This force of Pickett's is in more danger than I am. If I am cut off from the Army of the Potomac, it is cut off from Lee's army, and not a man of it should be allowed to get back to Lee. We at last have drawn the enemy's infantry out of their fortifications, and this is our chance to attack it." Federal losses at Dinwiddie Courthouse on the 31st. Sheridan had about 40 killed, about 254 wounded, and 60 missing. Southern losses are only estimates. They might have had 360 cavalry combined casualties and maybe 400 infantry. General Terry, one of the Southern commanders, was hurt when a cannon shot struck his horse and caused the horse to fall on him. And so his brigade would now come under the command of Colonel Joseph Mayo of the 3rd Virginia Infantry. Sheridan wrote to Grant that Pickett's force is, quote, "too strong for us. I will hold a Dinwiddie Courthouse until I am compelled to leave." So the plans that Grant had made up to this point had only been partially carried out. And they didn't look like at this point they were any closer of turning Lee's right flank or capturing the South Side Railroad that they had been back on the 29th. But now on April 1st, there's going to be a complete reversal of events. We'll talk about the Battle of Five Forks, often called the Waterloo of the Confederacy. If you remember, Bartlett had been detached, his small brigade had been detached to bolster Sheridan, and he made his appearance by dark of the 31st. And went into position in the rear of Pickett's left flank at the plantation of Dr. James Boysaw on the Crump Road. That won't be shown on your map. And at 8 o'clock that night, Meade ordered Warren to send a division to Sheridan at Dinwiddie Courthouse, and at 10:30 the order was given for the movement. I might add that there were very conflicting orders that Warren received about the movement of troops to support Sheridan. Ayres' division was moved by the Boynton Plank Road, but the bridge over Gravelly Run had to be reconstructed because of the high water, and it wouldn't be completed until 2 o'clock in the morning. He would not be able to join Sheridan until after daybreak. Griffin and Crawford, however, arrived about 7 o'clock at Dr. Boysaw's plantation. About 4 o'clock that morning, Pickett began a retrograde movement back to Five Forks, aware that Federal infantry were on his rear. Mumford's cavalry covered the infantry's movement along the courthouse road while Rosser's and Rooney's cavalry divisions recrossed Chamberlain's Bed and moved up Scott's Road. During the withdrawal, General Pickett received a very fateful message from General Lee. And this is going to be part of the... If you understand this message, you'll understand what basically takes place. Quote, hold Five Forks at all hazards. Protect road to Ford's Depot and prevent Union forces from striking the South Side Railroad. And then General Lee added, regret exceedingly your forced withdrawal and your inability to hold the advantage you gained. Okay. Is there any room in this order for discretion? That's it. This is what you will do. Okay. Dinwiddie Courthouse is about 6 miles from the southeast of Five Forks, and the South Side Railroad is about 2.5 miles north of the Forks. Okay. Okay. Now, the surrounding terrain in this area was mainly pine thickets cut by ravines and interspersed with bogs and with occasional clearings. Okay. When Pickett returned to the White Oak Road Five Forks area, he set his men to building log and dirt breastworks along the roadway. Now, when if you look at your map of Five Forks, if you can make that out, the earthworks that are prepared are south of the White Oak Road on the right flank of Pickett, and then they cross over to the north flank. Okay, now this is mainly flat, very flat terrain. There's no observation points that you're going to be able to get up on and see anything. Okay. Their line extended over 1.75 miles, with the left flank being refused by a return or angle about 150 yards long. So there on General Pickett's left flank, you'll note that there's a little turn to protect that flank. Okay. His combined infantry and cavalry force numbered about 9 to 10,000. Sheridan had about 9,000 cavalry, and Warren would have about, at this point, about 12,000 infantry. Okay. Now, Warren's men had been engaged at Lewis Farm. They'd been engaged at White Oak Road, and then they had to march through various obstacles to get to Sheridan's aid, so they've been under some duress themselves. On the left was Matt Ransom's North Carolinians and William Wallace's South Carolinians. Next was George Stewart's Virginians. And then crossing the forks, there was three pieces of artillery from Willie Pegram's battalion. And west of the forks were William Terry's Virginians under Joseph Mayo and the Virginians of Montgomery Corps, supported by three more guns of Pegram's battalion. That was pretty much the alignment of the infantry. Guarding the right flank were cavalrymen under Rooney Lee and his brigades of Beale and Barringer. And his other brigade was under William P. Roberts, who was the youngest Confederate general at 23. And he had a brigade of North Carolinians that were to cover the four-mile gap between Pickett's position at Five Forks and Anderson's position at Claiborne Road. Okay. Tom Mumford's Virginians guarded the immediate Confederate left flank and were supported by four guns of the horse artillery under William MacGregor. Thomas Ross, this is the one that Rick wanted to be in. This is the unit Rick wanted to be in. He wanted to be in Tom Rosser's division, who were sent a mile and a half north from the Forks across Hatcher's Run to guard the wagons. As his men continued to work on their entrenchments, George Pickett and Fitz Lee received an invitation. Not from Rick, but from Tom Rosser. To join him for lunch at his camp north of Hatcher's Run. Okay, nothing wrong. We'll go to lunch. The Federals apparently aren't doing much. They haven't followed us as much as we know. Meanwhile, the divisions, however, of Custer and Crook had set out in pursuit of the Confederates, Devin's division staying back at Dinwiddie Courthouse to guard their wagons. On the morning of the 1st, Sheridan also received some additional reinforcements from the Army of the James, Randall and McKenzie's two small cavalry brigades. This is also another turning point in the events in that Sheridan, while he impatiently awaited the arrival of Warren's infantry, and Sheridan was not a patient man, very impatient, and very verbose and outspoken. But he received a verbal instruction, a dispatch from General Grant that was carried by a courier, I believe Orville Babcock, and it said, "General Grant directs me to say that if you, in your judgment, the Fifth Corps could do better under one of the division commanders, you are authorized to relieve General Warren and order him to report to General Grant at headquarters." Grant had never been happy with Warren, going back to Spotsylvania Courthouse. Meade had not been, in fact, had written an order relieving Warren, which he later tore up and didn't send. And so Grant has little faith in Warren, and the events of the White Oak Road kind of gave him some more intuition that Warren was not the most aggressive commander he needed to get this job done. So he's given Sheridan the authority to relieve him. Yes, sir.
How did they communicate?
The couriers. Couriers. Men on horses. They didn't. Within the federal lines that were much more static, they had telegraphic communications. But when detached operations, they used couriers. And in fact, that's how Pickett got anything, was through couriers, too, being sent out. Grant is down here near Armstrong's Mill. Probably 5 miles, maybe 5 miles away. Okay. Now, Sheridan developed a battle plan for Five Forks, which is actually quite basic. Custer's division would feint an attack against the Confederate right, while the Fifth Corps would assault the Confederate left. The rest of the cavalry, the Federal cavalry, would press the Southern infantry to hold them in place. So the maneuver element is actually on the Federal right against the Confederate left. However, it was close to 4 o'clock in the afternoon when Warren had his force, about 12,000 men, ready for the attack. All of this time, Sheridan is just fuming. Their assembly point was just north of Gravelly Run Methodist Episcopal Church. And you'll see this on your map where it says Warren on the right there in dark letters. And you'll see the brigades lined up. And then you'll in that middle arrow of those three arrows, it says Gravelly Run's ME Church. Okay. That's where the Federal infantry forms up. They formed a battle line about 1,000-yard front. Warren was instructed the division commanders to move forward in echelon until they struck the White Oak Road. At that point, according to the sketch they had been provided with by Sheridan, they were to the wheel to the left and smashed the Confederate flank at the angle. Warren made no reconnaissance, as far as we know, of the Confederate position. Ayres formed the left of Warren's line, Crawford the right, and Griffin was held in reserve. It had taken close to 3 hours for Warren to move and ready his corps for the attack Sheridan had ordered. Sheridan felt that, quote, the impression that he wished that, about Warren, he said the impression that Warren gave him was that he wished the sun to go down before the dispositions for the attack could be completed. To the east of Warren, Randall McKenzie's cavalry attacked Robert's North Carolinians and scattered them without much resistance. The White Oak Road from Claiborne Road to Warren's right at Gravelly Run Church was now cleared of any Confederate. Pickett was isolated. Back in Pickett's line, Fitz Lee was preparing to leave for the Shadbake. That's what had, there had been some fish caught in the Nottoway River, and they were being prepared by General Rosser, and he invited Fitz Lee and Pickett. And now Fitz Lee was preparing to leave for lunch. Mumford rode up with a message that Robert's brigade had been forced to give up their position when attacked by some Yankee cavalry. But Lee, either, quote, impatiently hungry or uncritically skeptical, said, quote, well, Mumford, I wish you would go over in person at once and see what this means, and if necessary, order up your division and let me hear from you. Fitz Lee then rode off to Rosser's camp, leaving Rooney Lee in charge of the cavalry at the front. Well, you know where Rooney is. He's way over on the Confederate right flank. Since Pickett had already left to have lunch at Rosser's, George Stewart was in charge of the infantry, though he didn't know it. It appeared that none of the Confederate officers on the front line knew where the commanding generals had gone. Due to the faulty map that had been given to Warren by Sheridan, the angle the Fifth Corps was to assault was 3/4 of a mile to the west. Now, you would think at this time in the war that reconnaissance would be done, people guided into position, things would go according to a certain set plan of operations. But this battle does not. Leaving their position at the Gravelly Run Church about 4:15, it became necessary to realign Ayres' forces. Sheridan and Warren, however, rode in front of the troops. Mumford, who watched the Yankees from across the field, he watched all this being formed up, repeatedly sent messages to Fitz Lee and Pickett, but not one of the couriers could find them. They went all up and down the battle line, but they had no idea where they were. No one else knew. Mumford's troopers eventually had to give way to the advancing Union infantry. Sheridan ordered McKenzie's cavalry to cover Warren's right flank as it moved. Crawford's division was way out, was on the outward part of the wheel and lost contact with Ayres' right flank, causing Warren to ride away from the main column in an attempt to bring Crawford back into the battle. Remember, the terrain itself is wooded. And you'll see on your map those lines that go from where they formed up down at the Gravelly Run Church, and then those three lines kind of diverge and they move off in various manners. Mounted on his black horse Rienzi, Sheridan grabbed the red and white swallow-tailed guidon and rode up and down the battle line, encouraging the men to move forward. As the Union infantry approached McGregor limbered up his four artillery pieces, he left, and rode off toward Ford's Road. The Confederate left flank quickly crumbled. The Federals rounded up about 1,000 prisoners. Devens and Custer's troops kept the rest of the Confederates occupied along their front. Meanwhile, Crawford was still swinging away far to the north. Griffin's division fell in on Ayers' right and continued to advance down White Oak Road. With heftier numbers, the Federals surged ahead. Of course, they now had the flank of the Confederates, which is one of the weakest points, and they were able to easily overcome them while the Federal cavalry kept them occupied to their front. This time, the remnants of Ranson's and Wallace's command, along with Stuart's brigade, broke and fell back toward Ford's Road. That's the road that leads directly north of Five Forks. Warren finally caught up with Crawford and ordered him to wheel his troops to the left, facing south, and to advance on the Confederate rear at Five Forks. So, as it turned out, Crawford found himself in an ideal location behind the Confederates to move right into the rear. Because most of the battlefield was heavily wooded, with dense pines damped from recent rains, Pickett and Fitz Lee did not hear much of the firing taking place on their left flank. Some called this an acoustic shadow, that they were in this vacuum and they couldn't hear all of this commotion that was taking place. Maybe there was more going on than just fish. I don't know. They never have said. Maybe it was marinated fish. Pickett then witnessed the capture of one of Rosser's couriers by Federal skirmishers. He leapt on his horse, crossed Hatcher's Run, and immediately ran into Tom Mumford, whose cavalrymen were trying to stem the Federal advance. Pickett implored Mumford, quote, "Do hold them back till I pass to Five Forks." Captain James Breckinridge of the 2nd Virginia Cavalry charged with his troopers only to be shot and killed. His brave act, however, allowed Pickett to pass safely, and he was able to reach Five Forks. Fitz Lee formed Rosser's division along the northern bank of Hatcher's Run to prevent the Federals from crossing and moving against the Southside Railroad. When Pickett reached Five Forks, he made an attempt to organize and land a line of resistance parallel to Ford's Road. In other words, a line perpendicular to what their original battle line had been. He used the remnants of Stuart's, Wallace's, and Ransom's shattered brigades, most of Mayo's or Terry's brigade, and also to seek the support of McGregor's battery. Crawford now deployed his division, pushed aside Mumford's cavalrymen, captured three or four guns of McGregor's artillery, and scattered Mayo's brigade. Pickett ordered Mayo to move cross-country to try to reach the Southside Railroad as best he could. Every man for himself. Custer attempted to get around the right flank of Rooney Lee, but the Southern horsemen were able to prevent Custer from meeting the 5th Corps approaching from the east. Remember, we started this about a little after 4 o'clock, so it's starting to get later and later in the day. Oh, it's probably getting close to 5:45 or something like that. It's pretty rapid. Yeah, except for Crawford, no. He's going through the brush and the briars and the swamps and everything meandering out there to the north. The others are moving, having some guidance with the White Oak Road. At least they're using that as some directional. It was near sunset now when Warren called for his men to attack Corse's line, which was formed at right angles to the White Oak Road. The encounter was brief, and the Southerners either scattered or were taken prisoner. Because it was now getting darker, this aided the Confederates in the sense that they were able to get away. Rooney Lee's cavalry joined Mumford riding out a woods road that led north to the Ford Road. At that point, they went to Church Road Crossing on the Southside Railroad, where they met the remnants of Pickett's gathering men. Willie Pegram, the highly skilled artillery commander whose position was west of Five Forks, had a position west of Five Forks, and as Federal cavalry advanced in Pegram's front, he told his cannoneers to fire their canister low. Mounted on horseback, young Pegram, however, suddenly reeled in his saddle as a bullet struck his arm and side. Mortally wounded, he died the next day. Willie's brother, Brigadier General John Prigham, had been killed along Hatcher's Run in February. John's wife was Hetty Carey, considered the most beautiful woman in Richmond. And they had married not long before, well, I think about 6 weeks before her husband was killed. And, of course, the next time she would appear in St. Paul's Episcopal Church would not be in white, it would be in black. The victory was complete for Sheridan's forces. He had scattered the defending enemy troops, and the door was now wide open for access to the South Side Railroad. So we have a complete reversal of events from the White Oak Road engagement and Dinwiddie Courthouse. Grant received word of the breakthrough, and he ordered immediate assault along lines the next day, April 2nd. 7 days later, at a place called Appomattox Courthouse, it would all end. So this is why Five Forks is called the Waterloo of the Confederacy. Federal losses were about 830. Confederate losses are unknown, but about 545 killed. And more recent study indicates there were between 2,000 and 2,500 captured. General Lee would relieve of command on April 8th. Richard Anderson, George Pickett, and Bushrod Johnson. Nothing would be said about the Shadbank until almost the latter part of the 19th century. However, this is kind of a postscript. Upon returning from the attack against Corse, General Warren was informed that he had been relieved from duty and was to report to General Grant for orders after the battle. Warren immediately rode to Sheridan and asked him to reconsider his actions. The hot-tempered Irishman replied, quote, "Reconsider hell, I don't reconsider my determination." Charles Griffin was given then command of the 5th Corps, and Joseph Bartlett was given command of the 1st Division. Almost immediately, General Warren requested a court of inquiry. His request would not be granted until 1879. Warren was a Democrat. Grant was a Republican. Sherman was a Republican, and they were both commanders of the Army after the war, president, and so forth. So when the court convened in 1879, over 1,700 pages of testimony were taken from participants both north and south in the battle, as well as local landowners. And Five Forks is one of the most documented battles that we have in the Civil War period because of all of this testimony. Conditions, crops grown, where fences were, everything. It's all there in the reports. It is said that the general died, quote, "of a broken heart. He was buried without military funeral, in plain clothes, as he had come to shun all trappings of a soldier." Okay. If you go to Gettysburg, however, you see a statue of General Warren on top of a little round top. The only statue, well, I only know of two statues of Sheridan, but they're not on battlefields. One's in Albany, New York, and the other one's in Somerset, Ohio. I'm glad you could persevere through those four battles and maybe give you some insight as to what was taking place.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.